Hi, everyone. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is the A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that we see lying underneath.
Yeah, that's right. And we're on episode number 30, if you can believe that.
Wow.
And we're going to talk about Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte.
I couldn't resist. We had to do it.
I'm glad you did. Yeah, this is a book that I am very glad to have read, for sure.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
It surprised me. It wasn't quite what I expected. And we'll definitely get into that. But yeah. I enjoyed it.
Good.
Yes, I did.
Guys out there, I want you to think about that. Also, I would say very quickly before I describe what the book is, I read this book many times before I believed in God at all and just loved it. And then when I reread it a couple of years ago and then for this podcast, I was super surprised at how integral her Christian faith is, but it doesn't slap you in the face. So, you know, although we'll talk about all that, don't be afraid to read it because it's not like it's preaching at you.
Yeah.
I would say.
I agree.
So Jane Eyre, Jane was an orphan entrusted to her aunt by her dying uncle, and her aunt doesn't like her, and the cousins don't like her, and so she's pretty much picked on and winds up getting sent off to a boarding school, which is very Dickensian in quality, and there's not a good time there. And then later, she becomes a governess.
Not a good time there. That's fun.
No. Yes. Well, and ironically, it's a Christian-run orphanage, so no one's being spared here. And it's there, though, that she learns her trade, and then later becomes a governess for the ward of a gentleman who lives in a house secluded in the country. Him, his housekeeper, the little girl, and a few servants, and Jane. And I don't know how much more to say. Because it was originally called Jane Eyre, an Autobiography. So you kind of just see her life go through up to one point. But it is the most adventurous life you could ever imagine.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that was surprising to me, is some of the things that happened in this book. You know, I expected it to be like a Jane Austen novel, Pride and Prejudice, which is the only Jane Austen that I've read, but that's the one. And though it had elements of that, it was similar in a way. It was more than that. It was also kind of a gothic thing going on. You know, there's some ghost story elements in there. There's some action stuff in there. You know, it's a really good story. Every time when it got slow, it picked up, and it was just a story that just kept you reading. I never had any problem picking this book up and continuing. You know, I was looking forward to doing that. I was like, I need to go to that. It wasn't a chore at all.
Good. Well, and it's a romance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like I said, some elements are quite Dickensian. You know, you think of Oliver Twist. But at the same time, it's all filtered through Jane, who is very prosaic, I think, very normal person. I mean, every time she would talk about how she felt about something, I could relate to it.
Yeah.
She was very down to earth. And so that kind of anchors all these fantastical elements so that you feel like, well, this is, in a sense, even though there's all this adventure and all these things happen, nothing really happens that you can't relate to or understand. It kind of all flows very naturally, I thought.
Yeah, and I think so too. And I can imagine, not being any kind of an expert on the 1800s, this book was published, I looked it up, it was 1847.
Okay.
But not being any kind of an expert, what I do know is, you know, women weren't voting at that time and and things. I can just imagine that the character of Jane Eyre being so forthright and independent thinking and acting on those thoughts, I can imagine that people would have really liked that character. I mean, I could imagine this book changing someone's life.
Yeah, because, and I guess we'll get into talking about the details more in a minute, but I mean, one of her qualities is that she's not like Jane Austen characters, which tend to be a lot looking at manners and how people act versus how they think, which this does, but those characters all have learned very pretty ways to say what they think. And Jane will just say it. Mm-hmm. And then she'll go, oh, I probably shouldn't have said it like that.
Yeah.
You know, at one point, Mr. Rochester says, so what do you think? Am I a handsome fellow or something like that? And he's kind of joking around with her. And she says, oh, no, you're quite plain. And then she's like, oh, probably shouldn't have said that. And so he's poking her, you know, going and making fun of her because she said it. She's like, oh, I should have said this. And he's like, oh, my gosh, that's worse than what you said before. That backhanded compliment thing.
Yeah.
So, and that quality is there throughout the whole book. She's very straightforward. She says what she thinks, and what she thinks is very decided one way or the other,
mm-hmm.
and not silly usually.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
So, yeah. And so 1847, that would have been right before the Civil War.
Yeah. So and I kind of looked around to see kind of what was contemporary, and, Jane Austen, so Pride and Prejudice was in like the early 1800s. So 1813 is what I'm showing. Mm-hmm. And Frankenstein by Mary Shelley was 1818.
Okay, so those were much earlier. Well,
yeah,
about 30 years.
Yeah, about 30 years earlier. So Jane Eyre was published in 1847 and also active at that time. Charles Dickens was right in the middle of his publishing.
Okay.
So a year after that. Just looking here, David Copperfield came out in 1849. It started a serial in a magazine in 1849. So his most famous stuff, David Copperfield, Bleak House, A Tale of Two Cities, Great Expectations, Edwin Drood, those came after Jane Eyre.
Okay.
But things like Oliver Twist and Nicholas Nickleby came out before. So right in there. A Christmas Carol was 1843.
Yeah, so you don't know how much of it was influenced by the time and also by the fact that, you know, very famously, she and her two sisters, well, I guess it says she was the third of six children, but two of her sisters also wrote books. Emily Bronte wrote Wuthering Heights.
Yeah.
And Anne wrote Agnes Grey and The Tenant of Wildfeld Hall, which I've heard a lot of people mentioning lately in various places. Mm. I think just because they're something besides Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights.
How about that?
So I haven't read any of those. But they lived, you know, out on the moors in Yorkshire, kind of an isolated existence. And
And I read a little bit about the family.
Yeah.
And, you know, that must have been kind of an exciting house to live in. Most of them died early, though. Charlotte lived the longest. She died at age 38. So she lived to see publication. And I guess the other daughters, you know, didn't live to see their name.
Oh, really?
Any kind of famous, yeah.
Because the foreword to my book has the note to the third edition, so which was 1848.
Yeah.
So this thing was hugely popular, I guess, and just got reprinted like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see why. And I love that she and I don't know anything about Thackeray, but in her first preface, she has this very respectful note about, you know, what a mentor he was and how she looks up to him. And it's dedicated to him, to W.M. Thackeray, Esquire. This work is respectfully inscribed by the author. So whether she knew him or not, I don't know, but obviously he was a very big influence on her.
Well, nice.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, something that made me laugh is in 1842, Charlotte and Emily went to Belgium to enroll right. in a boarding school. And I was thinking, in Bruges? No, not in Bruges. In Brussels.
With much better language, I'm sure.
Yeah. So fun.
Yeah, because then I was seeing that it was really actually kind of sad in a way, because she returned to England because she was a governess for a while, it says, mm-hmm. and then taught in Brussels. And in 1846, she returned to England and, you know, obviously published Jane Eyre in 1847 to considerable acclaim, this says. And then it says she married in 1854 and died in 1855 of complications arising from pregnancy. And I was like, oh my gosh, yeah. She had less than a year with her husband.
Right. And she was pregnant when she died, and the baby died too.
Yeah, so the baby died also. Yeah, so I was just like, wow, who knows what happened. But yeah, so anyway.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
So
shall we jump into Jane Eyre?
Yes, and I advise you definitely read the book.
Yes, it was definitely worth it. Oh, I should mention, I have an audiobook that is tremendous. Let's see who. I'm trying to remember. I got it on iTunes, and I kind of read the reviews and happened to pick the best one. I'm sure.
Was it just a open free this one, like here. A podcast, or did you?
No,
pay?
No, I paid.
Okay, so it's an audiobook.
I got it on Audible.
Okay.
And let's see. I'm just typing. I want to make sure I give you the right name for the narrator, because it's someone I hadn't heard before, but she was superb. Really remarkable.
I have to listen to it.
It's called on Audible. It's called Jane Eyre RNIB edition. The narrator is Lucy Scott, and I'm not sure what RNIB means. That's the publisher. The publisher is RNIB. Okay. Yep. But Lucy Scott. It's on sale if you're a member for only $10.24 if you're out of credits. But the narrator is absolutely remarkable.
Wow.
So, thumbs up.
You laughed, you cried.
Oh, yeah. She speaks French and German, which are spoken in this thing. I mean, it was remarkable, yeah. And all of the characters, she acts. You know, this isn't a dry reading in any way.
Right.
And it's fantastic.
Okay.
Just great.
I will.
Can't say enough about it. So if you want to listen to it, that's the one to get. Lucy Scott.
Good.
Yep.
Did you say you went back and forth between reading and listening?
Oh, I did. Yeah. I had the text on the Kindle. Mm-hmm. And I would jump back and forth between reading and listening, and sometimes do both at the same time.
Okay.
Which really focuses me. If I'm having trouble focusing, if I, you know, listen and read at the same time, it's like it gets me in there, and then I could turn one or the other off and continue.
Mm-hmm.
I find that useful for things like this, in which sometimes if you're just listening, or me, you know, this happens to me, if I'm just listening, and the language in here, you know, the book is from 1847, so sometimes I will realize that, hey, I don't know exactly what's going on right now. I can back up and read it or whatever. But the thing, you know, the language is very good in this. Normally I did not have that trouble, but to see the words and in this, some sections, you know, it's very well written. It's neat.
Yeah. The language is surprisingly contemporary. I mean, if you think 1847, it's not like some of those where they're using very stilted language, I think.
Yeah.
Sometimes I didn't have any trouble reading. Some of the people talking well, but that also kind of conveys who they are sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Well, wow. Yeah, I had an old one that I'd read several times. And then when you said the Kindle, I went, oh, yeah, and downloaded it for the Kindle to look at it there. And then here's the problem with the Kindle. My husband had a couple books, work type books that he needed to read, but he could only read them on his computer because we're not so forward that we have iPads or anything like that. And so I've lent him my Kindle, so I can't get my hands on it.
Mm, yeah.
He's using it. But it looks like it was pretty easy to go through, and it was free that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yep. It went really well. Yep.
So, okay.
Cool.
Now we're going to talk about the actual story. Okay.
Sounds good.
Say the thing that really hit me when I was reading this, and I probably realized it every time, but more because, like I said, I was focused to talk with you about it, is how strong a character Jane is. She's got what you call moral fiber. And not in a pushy, obnoxious way like moral fiber makes you think. I mean, she knows who she is. She knows what her standard of conduct needs to be based on the fact that she's Christian.
Yeah.
And she doesn't talk about being Christian, but it obviously informs her, because I started at one point marking the places where just as little throwaway lines she'd say, well, I asked Providence this. I didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. So I threw my heart up to Providence and said, please, at least help me find a job I could stand. And then when I went to bed, I thought, here's what I should do. I should put an ad in the paper and I should do this. And she, okay. And she never says, it's an answer to prayer. There are a couple times. But yeah, other than that, it's just part of kind of how she's thinking and the internal struggles she may be having. So
yeah. And the book is told Jane Eyre is an adult looking back.
Yeah.
So every now and then she pops out and says something to the reader directly as the adult Jane Eyre. But the book, starts with Jane as a kid living in a house where she's not really welcome. She's an orphan and living with her aunt and uncle. But, you know, when you're talking about the Christianity.
Just her aunt.
Just her aunt. I'm sorry. That's Uncle's right. The dead. Uncle had died, right?
Yeah.
But the every now and then she throws in something. I guess what I want to say is that the book is filled with Christians who have wrong-headed ideas, too.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like she kind of knows what's going on. And despite some of the people, some of the adults that were around her at this time, like I had highlighted something here, there's a Miss Abbott. She says, God will punish her. He might strike her dead in the midst of her tantrums. And then where would she go? Come, Bessie, we will leave her. I wouldn't have her heart for anything. Say your prayers, Miss Eyre, when you are by yourself, for if you don't repent, something bad might be permitted to come down the chimney and fetch you away. So it's like...
Before they shut her up in a dark room by herself where her uncle was said to have died, so everybody's afraid it's haunted, and they shut this little kid up in there for a punishment and say that before they walk out the door.
Yeah, yeah. So, and there are people that are kind of like that. You know, she's showing this wrong-headed thinking throughout. You know, there's always a character, and she just seems to throw these things in. But it doesn't affect her beliefs in any way. You know, her beliefs are intact throughout.
She knows what's fair and right and logical, and she knows what isn't. And so what happens is everybody kind of gets judged against that when she's talking about him, and not in a way that's, well, I thought this. It's just the actions show him. Because I was thinking about the fact that when she's talking to the guy who runs the school, who's one of the biggest examples of Christian hypocrisy or any hypocrisy I've ever seen, Mr. Brucklehurst. And so he's kind of giving her all these questions because he's seeing if she'll be good for the school. Or, you know, to go to the school, the aunt's like, I'm getting rid of you. And so he's asking her, you know, what happens to naughty little children? She says, they go to hell, was my ready and orthodox answer. And what is hell? Can you tell me that? A pit full of fire, she says. And should you like to fall into that pit and to be burning there forever? No, sir. What must you do to avoid it? I deliberated a moment. My answer when it did come was objectionable. I must keep in good health and not die. It's like, and of course he's like, you can't really guarantee your good health. But the thing that was kind of interesting to me was that's the first time when you see she's like, well, this isn't the orthodox answer, but it's the answer I can come up with that, you know, seems the most, because you're telling me I'm naughty.
Yeah.
So I probably should not die. And a little bit later than they're talking about, well, you should be learning the Psalms by heart. That's how you become a good person. And she's like, Psalms are not interesting. Oh, what a wicked heart you have. But what she's doing is just saying what she thinks, and what she thinks is, you know, we all relate to that. It's really true.
Yeah, yeah, it
sure
is. And
that's how a kid would think.
Yeah, that was a funny moment.
But you see that quality developed throughout the book, so that when she's observing the conditions at the school, and there, you know, you see Mr. Brocklehurst and his hypocrisy in the way these kids are treated, and the way when he brings his own family in to observe them, and they're very richly dressed and well fed and all this, and these kids are literally starving. And hardly anything to wear. And I mean, it's really workhouse kind of conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But you always have the contrasting. It's never told to you like, and so see this. It's the way Dickens would have done it, through character development. Because there's the head of the school who shows how you really should be if you're a good person.
Mm-hmm.
There's Helen, who's obviously a Christ type figure. Unworldly, really.
Yeah,
she really lives it in a way that most normal people never could. And the contrast between her and Jane is very obvious, because Jane's regular.
Yeah.
Jane's like, I hate these people who are awful like this. And, oh, no, you mustn't do that. You know?
Yeah, right.
And I'm making it sound super boring, I guess.
No, not at all.
But what happens is because you see all these things, it's really interesting that once – conditions at the school reach ahead and everybody's been sick and Helen dies. If you imagine, she probably had TB or something, because she was always kind of sickly and Miss Templeton was always kind of worried about her health.
Mm-hmm.
And several years skipped ahead. And there I was, 18 or 17, whatever, and really tired of teaching there, and decided I'd go somewhere else, maybe find a job somewhere else. And she doesn't really talk about faith or anything much, again, the way she does in this book, where it's brought up because everybody's being told how you should act and how they're falling short. Here, once she goes to Mr. Rochester's, you see her having to live it in her life.
Yeah.
Through all these really gothic, great haunted house type temptations and examples.
The first example of kind of a gothic scene is when she was locked in that room by her aunt, her aunt's servants, mm-hmm. When she was, 8 years old or so?
Yeah.
There's a scene in there in which she thinks she sees a ghost. And, you know, did she or didn't she? We really don't Mm-mm. positively ever find out. But, that was a heck of a scene. It reminded me of things like Edgar Allan Poe and all that stuff. But it was definitely a scene of gothic horror. And to be hit with that, it almost seemed out of place. It was like, wow, this is kind of two books at the same time. You know, it surprised me because, you know, if we compare it to Jane Austen, you know, Jane Austen, her book is pretty much all this social stuff going on mm-hmm. and maneuverings and everybody, you know, saying what... You know, Elizabeth Bennet, you know, she was the most forthright of them all, you know, so she was thought to be, you know, this plucky person. But Jane Eyre, again, is straight spoken. But every now and then she talks about social stuff. And I think she kind of says it in distaste, you know, because she's always talking about how plain she is and how that affects her life. That same Lady Abbott says, mm-hmm. One of the things servant. I highlighted, yeah, if she were a nice, pretty child, one might be compassionate, or the sentence says, one might compassionate for her forlornness. That sounds like a typo, but one really cannot care for such a little toad as that. You know, so Jane Eyre, she's saying, you know, she's not a nice, pretty child. But pretty keeps coming up.
Yeah.
You know, she's not this, she's plain, you know, and that affects what kind of a social status she can reach.
And when she's the governess and there's a house party that comes with somebody who Mr. Rochester is rumored to be interested in marrying, mm-hmm. she's required to be part of the party sometimes in the evenings because the little ward Adele is going to be there. And so she sits in like the window seat or somewhere where she can kind of stay out of the way, but she'll observe how these people act and talk. And she always admires how they look, you know, oh, mm-hmm. so-and-so was so handsome and so-and-so looked like this. And she'll report on their conversation though. And it's then that you see the difference between the outer appearance and the inner behavior. And you really learn that, because we already knew it, but what you learn is that doesn't mean anything. And I think one of the things that's interesting to me is Jane will say, oh, because I was plain and this and that. And what you expect is that they're just not evaluating themselves properly, because that's how heroines are, right? Oh, mm-hmm. I was plain and this. And people go, no, you're beautiful. Everybody, oh, no, you're plain. You're plain little tiny thing, they always say. And yeah. even toward the end of the book, where she's, spoilers, you know, as we said, rediscovered Mr. Rochester, she hears, I think, John, the guy who's one of the servants who's taking care of Mr. Rochester, say, well, she's nothing to look at, but it's clear that to Mr. Rochester, she's the most beautiful person in the world. And yeah. Mr. Rochester is not handsome at all.
Right,
you know, when he
right.
was, I think he was played by George C. Scott once in one of the movies of Jane Eyre. And that's kind of how I always pictured him, kind of an ugly-ish, but commanding presence.
Yeah. And yeah, I remember her saying something about that. I don't think I highlighted it in any way, but yeah.
Because he'll ask her how he looks. And then am I handsome? You know, she's like, no. He's like, oh, you know, I mentioned that earlier. And she'll say, but it doesn't matter because I loved my dear master. He was all to me, you know. And so she's continually showing just through what happens that it's the person inside that matters, not how they look.
Because yeah, yeah. When she first met Grace, I highlighted that part too.
Yeah.
Had Grace, we'll talk about who Grace is in a minute, but had Grace been young and handsome, I should have been tempted to think that tenderer feelings than prudence or fear influenced Mr. Rochester in her behalf. But hard-favored matronly as she was, the idea could not be admitted. I don't think she can ever have been pretty, but for aught I know, she may possess possess originality and strength of character to compensate for the want of personal advantages. So she is kind of looking inside there. But again, you know, the narrator is an adult and has been through all this and is just remembering, you know, I guess foreshadowing things. But she says, yeah, maybe her strength of character. She must have strength of character to compensate for her want of personal advantages. And then, of course, it turns out that she does.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, Grace Poole is you don't know who she is for most of the story. She's the sinister character in the attic who lives in the attic, and she never really understands what she does, but everyone's, oh, she just lives up there. And
she's the suspect.
Yeah, she's definitely suspect.
Yeah. I guess it would be helpful if we talk about this book in sections, I guess. I mean, I don't mean that's going back, but really there's the first section is when she's 8 and at her aunt's house. And then the book moves on to where she's at school, at the boarding school, which she's there for like 7 years, even teaching the last two. She becomes a teacher. And then it moves on to Rochester's house where she's a governess. And then after that, she ends up...
And she becomes, at the very end of that period, she becomes engaged to him.
Mr. Rochester? No, she does. She doesn't quite at that time.
At right? The end of that
it's an attempt to, and then she declines him.
Well, no. Before she runs away, she's engaged to him for a month.
Oh, gosh, that's absolutely right. Yes. And then we find out something, dun, 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 and then...
The horrible secret.
Yes, the horrible secret.
Rochester.
That's right. I'm sorry. I don't... Yeah. That's right. So she's engaged to him, and then she leaves. And then, you know, the book could have ended right there, but it went on. Yeah. And then she ends up at a school where...
Teaching a village school.
Yeah, she's teaching a village school. And then, you know, there's more characters there. Another guy who wants to marry her. And then the very short end piece where she's back with Mr. Rochester.
Yeah.
So Grace Poole is someone who lives at Mr. Rochester's house. And again, you know, we had that kind of a gothic horror piece when she was living in her aunt's house. Mm-hmm. But now as an adult, she's living in this giant mansion with Mr. Rochester, and she is the governess to, I don't think he ever adopted, it's a French girl named Adele that he
she's
took
just
in.
His ward. Yeah.
So she's his ward. And anyway, Mr. Rochester is kind of a mysterious, blunt type of guy. And Grace Poole is a servant in that house, but she just doesn't understand what she's actually doing.
Yeah.
And she hears voices, you know, so, you know, she definitely believes in
crazy
ghosts
laughter.
And yeah, crazy laughter in places. And she's sure that Grace Poole is not on the up and up. Something's going on with Grace the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And she'll mention it to maybe Mrs. Fairfax, the housekeeper, who a very comfortable older lady who's always like, oh, Grace is fine. Don't worry about Grace. And she'll like be going, but that crazy, odd laughter. Oh, no, that's just her way. And things will happen like, you know, at one point she smells smoke. She's up late. She smells smoke. And there's this fire that's been set in Mr. Rochester's bedroom while he's asleep. Isn't that it? And she has to kind of wake him up and help put the fire out. And
she's
like, I'm pretty sure it was Grace Poole. He's like, no, it wasn't Grace Poole. It was fine. It's I'll take care of it. You go back to bed.
Yeah.
Everything's okay. Thank you so much, Jane. You're wonderful for saving me.
Right. And then, you know? Yeah. And then, an old friend of Rochester's shows up during a party.
From the islands.
Yeah. From the islands, and ends up getting bit in the night. So he wakes up and he's bleeding.
That's right.
He's bitten and bleeding. It's like, right.
Jane, are you awake? I could you can't come help me?
Could you come here a second, please?
Could you come up to the attic? Because I need a little help with this situation. I can't tell you anything about it.
So yeah, could so they just... help. She helps him patch him all together. And then later, when he asks her to marry him, and she says, but I have just one question. And I'm thinking, oh, right. Yeah, we're going to find out what the whole, all this biting was.
What's going on with Grace Poole?
But it wasn't. That's not what she asked. She asked something like, why did you pretend to love Blanche?
Yeah.
And I was like, what? It's like all this, you know, hey, there's somebody in the house that's biting people. But what I want to know is about this Blanche person.
It's like bedrooms on fire and stuff at night with crazy laughter.
That's right. But this is what the most important issue to me is Blanche. And then, you know, once she decides that Blanche is not a threat anymore, she says okay to this guy. And of course,
I'm going to tell you how differently a girl reads this. Uh-huh. Never occurred to me that she should have asked any other question. I'm just like,
oh man, that's hilarious.
Yeah, why? Why was he pretending to be interested in Blanche? Because you know what? That's not right. You know, she was all wrong for him. Why was he doing that?
I don't know. I don't know if I can find that spot in this book.
That's the romantic aspect that the girl is going to.
Yeah, this is going on and on and on. Like, I just you know, she's agonizing about it. I just have this one question, this very important thing, you know, paragraph. All right, here it comes. We're going to find out what the biting's all about, but no, it's not Blanche.
But but, you know, but that's, she wanted to know, do you really love me?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what mattered more than anything to her was, aside from anything extraneous, what mattered was if he really loved her. And could he be so fickle to Blanche? Or she never understood all that, because he'd act like they had a special relationship. And it wasn't that he ever actually kind of came on to her, really. It's just that they were really, really special friends, you know, in that way that you can be with somebody you fall in love with.
Right.
Because that's part of it. You're partners.
Mm-hmm.
And so he never had that with Blanche. And really, Blanche was just a diversion for him.
Yeah,
as it turns out, because I'll have to tell the secret.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He had been married to somebody. He'd been tricked as a young man when he was in the islands for, I guess he'd been sent there to, you know, further his manly education. by his father and brother who were scheming to get his money away from him or get more money. And so they married him to this rich heiress who everybody hid the fact that her family had insanity running through it. Mm. And so fairly young, they would go insane. And she was okay for a year or two and got crazier and crazier. And pretty soon there was nothing for it but to lock her up in the attic with Grace Poole to take care of her. And problem was, Grace Poole, as we could imagine, every so often she had, you know, to release a little tension with the gin bottle. And she'd fall asleep, and Bella,
yeah, that made me laugh.
Bertha, the wife, would get a hold of the keys and go, "Mr. Rochester, I hate you. I'm going to set the bedroom on fire while you're asleep," kind of thing.
Yep. So. Yeah. And then, yeah, so they're at the altar when she finds this out.
It was very dramatic.
Yeah, very dramatic. So
the marriage shouldn't go forward.
And she says something like, "No one ever says anything when the pastor asks that." And then, of course, there's this guy.
"No one ever says anything.
I have something." So, yeah. And then what follows that is this excruciating chapter in which she's telling him that, "No, I'm not going to stick around." And he's trying to talk her into staying. He's basically saying, "But you could be my mistress and all would be well." But she's saying, "No, you're married to this other person and this just isn't going to happen. You know, I'm not going to do it."
But he won't use the word mistress.
Yeah, but that's really what he's saying.
"You'd be my wife. We just won't have had the clergy." And she's like, "You've," and I can't remember if she just said this or thought this at other times, where she's like, "You've had another couple of mistresses before. I've heard about this. And where are they now?" You know, and she wasn't actually blaming him. She was just going, "I know what's right, and you're married. I can't do it." And he's like, "No, I love you and only you. It'll be like we're married." And she's like, "Nope. Mm-mm. Not going to happen." And she was just agonized, torn apart, because she wanted to do it so much.
Yeah.
But she just knew it wouldn't turn out right. And it was like, it's not just I have to follow the rules. It's those rules are there for a reason. Later on, without us having a true bond of real marriage, something would happen and it would be easy to cast me away. Which I thought was an interesting... it would have been the regular viewpoint for then, but looking at it in terms of behavior now, I just thought he is acting in the way that so many people act now in terms of, no, it's not fair. I was tricked into marrying her. Mm-hmm. What am I supposed to do? And she's like, "You know what? This is just the hand we were dealt, and it's awful, but we have to live with what we've got. Here's what's real. You are married, and I can't be your mistress, and this is what we have to live with." And I just thought, she's 18 or not quite 18.
Mm-hmm.
What a strong person who, though she's dying inside, she's like, and at one point she says, this is when we have to cling to our principles. She says, okay.
I've got a little.
Inwardly, she's saying, he says, reason turned... "My conscience and reason turned traitors against me and charged me with crime and resisting him. They spoke almost as loud as feeling," which is capitalized, "and clamored wildly. 'Oh, comply,' it said. 'Think of his misery. Think of his danger. Look at his state when left alone. Remember his headlong nature. Consider the recklessness following on despair. Soothe him. Save him. Love him. Tell him you love him and will be his. Who in the world cares for you? Or who will be injured by what you do?' Still indomitable was the reply. 'I care for myself. The more solitary, the more friendless, the more unsustained I am, the more I will respect myself. I will keep the law given by God, sanctioned by man. I will hold to the principles received by me when I was sane and not mad as I am now. Laws and principles are not for the times when there is no temptation. They are for such moments as this, when body and soul rise in mutiny against their rigor. Stringent are they, inviolate they shall be. If at my individual convenience I might break them, what would be their worth? They have a worth, so I have always believed. And if I cannot believe it now, it is because I am insane, quite insane, with my veins running fire and my heart beating faster than I can count its throbs. Preconceived opinions, foregone determinations, are all I have at this hour to stand by. There I plant my foot. Hmm. I did.
Hmm. Yeah, that's powerful stuff.
Yeah, and that's when you're just like, holy moly, that's true. All you have to, I mean, you can't, at moments like that, if more of us said, I'm not thinking straight, I'm crazy, I'm being influenced by things that I, that aren't reasonable right now. Mm-hmm. I have to just cling to what I know is true and let the rest sort itself out later. Mm. It's that momentary anguish, but how much better are we off?
Yeah, yeah. The, what you I heard in that same chapter, mm-hmm. he says, what shall I do, Jane? Where turn for a companion and for some hope? That's after he started to kiss her, and he says, do you still feel this way? And she says, yes. Do you still feel this way? Yes. And he's like, well, what am I going to do? And she says, do as I do. Trust in God and yourself. Believe in heaven. Hope to meet again there. Then you will not yield? No. Then you condemn me to live wretched and to die accursed? His voice rose. I advise you to live sinless, and I wish you to die tranquil. Then you snatch love and innocent from me? Innocence for me, you fling me back on lust for a passion, vice for an occupation. Mr. Rochester, I no more assign this fate to you than I grasp it for myself. We were born to strive and endure, you as well as I. Do so. You will forget me before I forget you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, yeah, she's, you know, so it, that was really powerful because, you know, and unexpected because I expected her to be talked into this.
And I really did. I really did.
Yeah.
Were reasonable. I mean, mm-hmm. he's like, I know what I'll become if I don't have somebody like you to help me, you know, as an anchor, if I'm miserable.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it before and you know it. So he, you know, you've got to help me. And she's, no, I, you know what? We each have to do our own thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's what I hope for you. And I hope it for me. And yeah. And think about, and, you know, there are always exceptions to everything. But you think about this kind of moral strength. And, you know, it does lead her to great suffering. Later, she knows he could probably talk her into doing what he wants to. And she knows she has to leave. Because she's not going to give in, and it's just going to be awful. Because she could hear him walking around the bedroom early in the morning. She knew he was just marshaling his arguments. And she just knew that it was just going to kill her. So she ran away. Mm-hmm. And it almost dies in the running.
Yeah, she's got, you know, she's turned into a beggar.
Because she forgot her bundle on the
She had, she didn't even have enough to get. Yeah, she didn't even have, she had to spend all that money to travel, you know?
Right.
So she'd spent all the money. And then when she got out of the coach, she left her bag on the coach. So she had nothing but what she was wearing. And was about 3 days like that, just wandering around, finding a piece of bread. Someone give her a piece of bread. And then she found this house.
Eating the porridge that the pigs, was going to be given to the pigs and mm-hmm. stuff. I mean, she was really reduced to nothing.
Yeah.
Only had herself and God to lean on.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
And then she ended up at this house where she just kind of watched in the window and saw three people, a servant and two women in the kitchen, you know, when she could hear them talk and things. And anyway, finally she got up her courage and knocked on the door and said, please help.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And they didn't want to help.
No.
Or the servant
was
turned her
skeptical.
So you're going to scam us somehow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She's like, no, I'm dying. I'm literally dying right here. And they're like, nope. And the two young ladies, you know, they asked who was at the door, but they didn't know what to do. And then their brother, who was out and is coming home, he's kind of seen the whole thing from afar. And that's kind of an interesting introduction to him now that I think about it, because instead of stepping in at that moment, mm-hmm. as most of us would have done, he very coolly stays back and observes what's going on. And then when the conclusion is done, he steps forward and says, no, I'm pretty sure she's dying. Let's take her inside and feed her and put her to bed.
Yeah.
And he's a very interesting character, especially as the antithesis to Mr. Rochester.
Yeah, yeah. And he's in the book, he's called Mr. St. John. And the narrator called him St. John. Yeah,
St. John
the whole time.
Yeah.
British. Right, so that's kind of how I know him as. And
St. John.
And he was an interesting character, too, because he's very pious. But yet he gets it wrong, too, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because what happens is, I guess the short version, he falls in love with her. Well,
no, he doesn't.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Wrong.
All right. He asks her to marry him, but Jane is positive that he doesn't love her and that she is a tool in his toolbox. That's what he wants, is another tool in his toolbox for missionary work. And because that's all, because she's convinced that that's all she is to him, she couldn't possibly do it.
But he is at her day and night. Because what happens is basically she stays with the family. She discovers that the brother's a pastor and she's very much in admiration of his character and his learning, and the way homilies he gives are very moving. And she gets kind of in an interesting, strange, intellectual kind of way. They lift you up, so that's really great. But even with his sisters, he's very detached.
Mm-hmm.
He almost made me think of like Mr. Spock.
Yeah,
almost like a Vulcan. He was striving for that lack of emotion, and he does love one person. And it's very obvious she loves him back, and that's the daughter of the local landowner.
Yes, right.
And he's like, yes, but it's very clear to me that my purpose in life is to go off and be a missionary. And everybody tries to talk him into approaching this girl who's very, she's dropping hints, she's hanging around, she likes him. And he is so determined that I know what I'm supposed to do that he turns away from love, which is the thing I found interesting, because that could have made him human. He wasn't willing to lose control.
Yeah, it was almost like a penitential thing for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's like, well, in order for me to do this, I must need to suffer kind of a situation. Because when Jane does tell him no, she says, I'm not going to marry you because you don't love me.
Right.
And he says, well, you're going against God's will, so I'm going to pray for you. Yeah.
Yeah, it was one of those. And the thing was, is he really believed it, and everybody could see it wasn't really necessarily so. And they admired his ideals, but even his sisters were like, he really shouldn't do this, but we can't stop him. And then when he wants Jane to come with him, they're like, it will kill you. 3 days on the moor practically did you in. You're not going to be able to live in a tropical, because he was going to go to the islands or South America.
India or something like that. I think you're right.
India, that's right, because he was learning Hindustani.
Yeah, and they were, and you know, Jane does not have the best, constitution. You know, she's pale and small, and they're sure that, you know, she wouldn't survive it. I mean, physically survive.
Right. And he's like, well, that's a chance we'll have to take. And Jane keeps saying, listen, I really don't have anything left here. I am perfectly, if you think this is what I should do, I'm willing to go with you as an assistant. And it's like, oh, no, we can't do that because you're a young female. Not going to do it. And I'm thinking, really? This is where you can't stand up to what anybody thinks? You know? But he's like, nope, we'll be married or nothing, because that's his plan.
Right.
And so he just starts day and night. It's the will of God. You're going against the will of God. She's like, ugh. It's doing this so much, I don't even know what to think anymore. I just keep clinging to this idea that he doesn't love me the way dear Mr. Rochester did. And so you've got the two contrasts of the one person who's determined to be holy and do what he perceives as God's will, and Mr. Rochester, who's totally driven by his passions, except when Jane's his anchor.
Right, right.
But the person who's told, but St. John, who's driven by, I will just do what God wants, and that means not loving and not being really a full human, he's less likely to consider Jane as a person at all.
Yeah, yeah. That's how I felt about it too.
Yeah.
Yep. So we agree on that, even though I would have asked what was with the biting. This guy that was bit, that was important.
Yeah, that I had to stay all by myself while you guys went off for the doctor. What the heck, yeah. People? Well,
you know, if I had to highlight one sentence that yeah. would remind me of Jane Eyre,
yeah,
it's just four words. It was, "Reader, I married him."
Right. And that's the most famous line in the whole book.
Is it really? Because, I mean, it jumps yeah. out at you. And it says so much because...
It's so wonderful.
Yeah, because, you know, it's not we got married. It's not he married me. and that's why I think that Jane Eyre would have been such an inspirational character to women of that time. Mm-hmm. She was saying, "I married him." You know, she made the decision. Things right. worked out for her. All the stuff that she went through... she made that decision and she did it. And then the reader part of it is, you know, us. Jane Eyre telling yeah. us that, you know, she's right. stepping out, which she did through various times in the book, like yeah. I said,
reader, this happened.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Every now and then she just jumps out of the story and tells you something.
Every so often you'll see somebody say, "Reader, this happened." Well, mm-hmm. that's because they're playing off of that one line. And yeah. it's
and now I know that, which is one of yeah, the reasons why I'm so happy to have read this.
Well,
you know?
And it's interesting, too, because you look at the fact that, you know, she went through all this gothic stuff, but it was really necessary because Mr. Rochester had to be humbled himself in order to really fully... I don't want to say appreciate Jane, but in a way that's one of the results of it. But as a human being, he was still being driven and not giving up control. He was being driven by his passions, as he said, and all these things. The only, because when Jane says she'll marry him, mm-hmm. he's still like, "Yay, I'm going to buy you diamonds and gowns and all." And Jane's like, "Whoa, that's not me." And mm-hmm. he's like, "It doesn't matter. It is to you." So he instantly starts acting the way he would have anyway. And she's like, "Whoa, this is not what I saw. I love you, man. But mm-hmm. no, I'm very uncomfortable with this." And so he's not willing to really give up control of anything. And you think about it and think, she loves him, but she would have always been fighting over this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably not necessary that he was blinded, but he obviously had to experience a humbling in order to consider other people before himself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, because he really is at the end when she goes back to him, and the way she's called back to him is truly divine providence's hand.
Mm, yeah.
They have each has a separate supernatural experience. And that's what calls, because she, right before that, she says, "Lord, what am I supposed to do?" Or something, you know, she's like, "I can't, oh, that's it." Because she's like, "If I was convinced it was God's will, I should marry you." And she's talking to St. John. Mm. "I'd vow to marry you here and now, come afterwards what would." And he says, "My prayers are answered." ejaculated St. John. He pressed mm-hmm. his hand firmer against my head as if he claimed me. He surrounded me with his arm almost as if he loved me. I say almost. I knew the difference. For I had felt what it was to be loved. But like him, I had now put love out of the question and thought only of duty. I contended with my inward dimness of vision, before which clouds yet rolled. I sincerely, deeply, fervently longed to do what was right and only that. Show me the path, I entreated of heaven. I was excited more than I had ever been, and whether what followed was the effect of excitement, the reader shall judge. And so what happens is she gets this, suddenly there's this feeling like an electric shock, mm-hmm. almost.
Yep.
And St. John's right there, and it's like, "What are you hearing? What do you see?" And she's hearing Mr. Rochester say, "Jane, Jane, Jane." And she says, "What is it?" And so she runs out of the house and says, "I'm coming. Wait for me. I'll come. Where are you?" And there's nothing. Mm-hmm. And everything. And she says, "Well, that was just superstition." And so then, though, she knows she has to go find out what happened to him. Why have none of her letters ever been answered? And you find out later, and she never tells him about her part of it. At least in the book, you find out later that he was really at the depths of despair, and he was going, "Jane, Jane, Jane, where are you? You know, I need you so much." And he hears her answer. And I've seen in the afterward, they're like, "Well, we don't know. She says that could have been the excitement. You know, that's, you know, doubtless how the author meant it." And I'm like, "Have you read the rest of the book? Because I'm really thinking not." See, yeah. She just said, "Heaven, tell me what to do."
Mm-hmm.
And every time she asks that question, whether it's should I get a job or whatever, something comes up that, whether it's natural seeming or not, is an answer to show her how to go. It's not the easy way always, but it leads her where she needs to go. And when she goes back, what she finds is somebody who has been completely humbled. He's blind. He's lost one hand. Because his house burned, because, you know, his crazy wife burned his house down finally, and he went back to save everyone himself. So that shows his selflessness and his responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And he even goes to try to save her, and he has to go up to the roof to do it, and she throws herself off at the last minute, and then it all collapses, and he's barely pulled out alive.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, that was something else. Yeah.
Come along. Yeah, talk about gothic. Wow, what a scene.
Yeah, giant mansion.
Yeah.
Yep.
When they're describing it to her.
Right. So, yeah, so that's the guy she marries. It's him. You know, reader, I married him. And then I found it interesting that the last paragraph of the book was St. John's.
I know.
That was that you know, that left me hanging. I mean, I thought about that for a while. After finishing that, I was like, "Oh, wow." You know, it's interesting. So, you know, the very final words of this novel are, "Amen, even so come, Lord Jesus." Mm-hmm. Which is from a letter written by St. John to Jane, saying that he's probably going to die. Right?
Yeah, and you're right, because she kind of wraps it all up. She's like, "Well, his sight, Mr. Rochester's sight, started coming back after a while, and he, when our baby was born, he was able to see his face pretty much."
Yeah,
and you know, these two sisters of St. John's, here's what happened with them, and we all visit back and forth, and it's just a wonderful life. And then, yeah, there's two solid paragraphs about St. John and. "Firm, faithful, and devoted, full of energy and zeal and truth, he labors for his race. He clears their painful way to improvement. He hews down like a giant the prejudices of creed and caste that encumber it. You know, he may be stern, he may be exacting, he may be ambitious yet, but his is the sternness of the warrior Greatheart, who guards his pilgrim convoy from the onslaught of Apollyon." And she goes on like that and then says, "Yeah, he's unmarried, he's dying." I could tell from his last letter. And I had a long conversation and argument, really, with somebody on my blog when I reread this a couple years ago, because I was like, "St. John, what an idiot, right?" And she's like, "No, she thought he was completely worth admiring." And I'm like, okay, based on these last two things, what he did with his life was noble. And she basically, to me, was saying, "Well, this is where he went. I couldn't stop it. And what he did was absolutely noble."
Yeah. "No fear of death will darken St. John's last hour. His mind will be unclouded. His heart will be undaunted. His hope will be sure. His faith steadfast." Yeah.
But the thing that we don't know, and I don't know if this is as a modern reader or not, you look at it and you go, yes, he went on and he did really great things, obviously, according to this. But would he not have done equally great things by staying and being married to the girl he was supposed to marry, who they were like, "Well, maybe she wouldn't have suited him after a year, so it might have been like this." I'm like, but what if it wasn't? What if, you know, as marriage does, you help each other get to heaven by making each other better people?
Yeah.
And helping each other on the way. And what would he have done for the village there and all that stuff? And so... And the fact that he was doing everything just by his sheer force of will and denying part of himself. How much of that do you control and how much do you not, even though you're doing great and noble things? I mean, she doesn't raise that question, but it's the question I'm always left with.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. Time for part two.
which I guess we get that in heaven if we all make it there with
Charlotte. When I was looking for this on Amazon a few weeks ago, there are a couple of books called Mrs. Rochester that are written by other people.
And there's a book called The Sargasso Sea, if that's how you say it. I think that's written about from the point of view of Bertha, the crazy wife in the attic.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a modern, obviously a modern book that would even think about writing it from that point of view. And I, where did I
That's read? Interesting. I don't know.
It may be on Goodreads. Because I was like, I've heard of this book, but I didn't realize that's what it was about. And I thought, you know what? I am completely disinterested in what happened later to these people, mm-hmm. or Bertha's point of view, or anything else. It's like Gone with the Wind, which you also haven't read, but you know, a few years ago or so, mm-hmm. people were writing sequels.
Yes, that's right.
Scarlet.
It must have went in public domain or something.
Yeah. 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 No, it hasn't. Or you find people reading it on LibriVox because it's true. Also, it's like this book, but of course much longer, but it's mm-hmm. also the most wonderful read. And sometime I'll warn you like 3 months ahead and we'll do it because it's really an amazing book.
Oh, cool.
In a lot of ways. But I just looked at that and thought, you know what? I think that they said everything that needed to be said. You're left to yourself. That's kind of the nice thing about leaving it open-ended, like To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. Possibly the most perfect book ever written of its sort. Mm-hmm. You know, why write? You don't need more.
Yeah, yeah. 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 Well, I can't argue with it at all. I thought it was something else.
I'm so glad.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really surprised by it. I thought it would be a slog. I thought it would be long. Really,
I'm glad I
thought it's like would be Jane Austen, but not as good.
Oh,
but yeah, I think you have the opposite feeling there. I do like Pride and Prejudice very much.
I do also.
But this was really excellent. I never didn't want to get to it. You know, when I say, mm-hmm. "All right, I get some time to read, I'm going to read this." Yeah, and
good.
Thumbs up.
I'm so glad.
Well, hey, we need to talk about. Jane Eyre as a YA character.
Because I basically had just read The Hunger Games right before this.
Yeah, and I did as well. I had read it before, but I ran a book club.
Yeah.
I just went through it with a fine-tooth comb, The Hunger Games. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was interesting that you brought that up.
Well, yeah, because I really liked The Hunger Games mm-hmm. as YA, meaning young adult, lit, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, set in a dystopian future, and, you know, you've got, to me, the inventiveness of the situation and her surviving the Hunger Games and the things they threw at them and the twists on the Hunger Games that I didn't expect in just how it was set up were fascinating, and I just sped through it. But, to me, the big weakness was Katniss, which is the main character's character. It was so textbook for right now what a female heroine should be. And I wound up having a talk with Rose, my 21-year-old, about that. And she wrote an email because she wanted to hear what you as a guy and what our podcast listeners might think about this, because she was pointing out, she sat down and said, here's the 6 traits of a YA dystopian fantasy female protagonist. Mm. And I would contend this goes beyond just dystopian fantasy. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the template of our times. Just like Nancy Drew was, you know, the female character that, you know, everybody was stamping out something like that back in the 50s or 60s or whatever. Here's the one now, which is she's independent to the point she spends little time with her family, who she loves, and relies little on her family or friends for help. They're always outsiders, that kind of thing. And she has a lack of self-awareness of her good qualities, including but not limited to physical attractiveness, intelligence, leadership, which she generally has in abundance. So she's prone to self-doubt. She has little to no interest in romance, unless with a childhood friend whom she views as inaccessible. And so then she's uninterested in her own beauty and being girlish. Says she's averse to a leadership position, but excels when it's thrust upon her generally because of a special ability she discovers she has. She's proficient or aspiring to be at a physical skill, such as hunting, combat, or survival. She's surprisingly unobservant or uncritical of society until shown its flaws by someone else, typically her love interest. However, she's perceived as being highly intelligent because of her tendency to speak her mind, something she attributes to how bad she is at lying. And Rose's conclusion, and I, to me, the reason I'm reading this is because I agree with her. Mm-hmm. She says, this is meant to define her as a woman of action, a strong, independent female protagonist worthy of admiration. And it says, however, the one trait relied on to make her strong is her physical skill and possibly leadership quality, you know. And so an absence of those traits leads you to Bella in Twilight, who's criticized all the time as being weak and passive. Hmm. And she says, while this simplistic view of strength is likely to appeal to the girls it is written for, these types of novels have a much wider audience and reflects the general rejection of the domestic goddess image that dominated literature for centuries. And so that would be the kind that Pride and Prejudice with Elizabeth Bennet or that mm-hmm. Jane Eyre belongs to. And it says, stereotypically, the domestic goddess is a weak, passive woman who waits for a man to save her. And while there are numerous examples of this, there are many notable exceptions. And Penelope from the Odyssey has great strength of will in her determination to avoid a second husband. She's very crafty in how she does it and puts herself in danger to do it. And she says, internal feminine strength extends to female protagonists throughout literature, including Jane Eyre, Fanny Price from Mansfield Park, which I haven't read, Dorothea from Middlemarch, which is on my reading list, and Hester Prynne from The Scarlet Letter. They display a strength, both emotional and mental, that surpasses the dystopian protagonist's physical strength. Somehow this sentence got mixed up. But it says, with conviction and purpose, basically. It says, they don't need the false modesty of this dystopian protagonist because they have a true self-knowledge of their strengths and weaknesses that gives them the strength and maturity to affect their society in a constructive way and serve as an example to others. So her question is, has the modern woman lost her true strength to this pale imitation of masculine heroics with this common heroine presented now? Are there any of the original, truly original, realistic women in YA dystopian fantasy novels today, or has the future really lost the wisdom of the past? So we can see where her heart lies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have a tendency to agree, except that I do know I loved reading Nancy Drew, you know, being of an older generation. So I don't begrudge people these stereotypes because it kind of reflects the society we're in now and what they admire. But I really was unable to think of a YA protagonist who stands apart from that stereotype as truly her own person in the way that Jane Eyre does, or Penelope, or you know, some of these, Hester Prynne. I was trying to think.
And I can't either. You know, certainly Katniss is not it. Katniss, you know, she's at the whim of her situation. You know, and she described Katniss pretty well, you know, in those things. Yeah. That is what Katniss is.
Right, because it's a type.
But yeah, and it seems ever since Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the kick-ass woman, I think, is something that has really become prevalent. Prevalent enough to where it's not surprising, you know, where you see a woman beat up a group of ninjas or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and then that's, you know, how is that significant? I really don't know, but her sentence saying that it's some kind of a male imitation. So, you know, to be a better woman, you need to be a male imitation. That is something that I think is not a good thing.
Agreed.
But, and that does seem to be the way that, society has gone. Don't you think, you know, I think about it, that's the way it seems to me, is that, you know, becoming more male, I guess, is kind of a goal,
I think in
ambition and, you know, in the business world or whatever, you know, if you want to be good, maybe being more like in the male world is what you're striving for. I don't know. It's like I'm tiptoeing around because I feel like, you know, I don't want to be sexist or anything.
Well, I completely agree with you because, well, it's that same thing. I think we've talked about it before is, you know, all the commercials, the husband's the bumbling idiot. Mm-hmm. And it's the wife and kids who are like, honey. Mm-hmm. And in sitcoms, it's that way, too, a lot of the time. And it's this almost a prejudice against having a strong male figure. And, you know, that's the thing of the complementary nature of men and women. And the problem is, I think, you know, there's that pendulum swinging back and forth of extremes. Which is why people celebrated, you know, Rosie the Riveter from the 40s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it was something that people had forgotten, you know, the pioneer women. I mean, I think, in fact, now that I think about it, Laura from Little House on the Prairie was not actually of that time with the YA lit. Mm-hmm. But she's a character who is kind of in between both times, but because she was correctly portraying what she really thought and felt, she's a very strong person. And you probably haven't read any of those books, or I guess you could have with your daughter.
I actually didn't, but I saw the show.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, I don't know.
Not
I didn't
quite
really,
as good, huh?
It was okay, but it was stuck in time.
Ah.
You know, I mean, she moved on and did all kinds of other stuff, and it just showed her growing up and the stuff she did. But she was kind of like Jane Eyre in a way. You know, she wound up helping support the family, and her, you know, her older sister goes blind, and she winds up helping support her family because that's what you did until you got married. You went out and got a job, and you gave most of your money to your family because that's what you did. And guys would do it too then. And she wound up in some super dangerous situations just because of life on the prairie. You know, you're having to go live in these different people's households while you're being the schoolmistress of some little community, and there are some crazy people.
Yeah.
You know, much like, in fact, one situation that really stands out, very much like the crazy lady in the attic here, you know, and she just had to get through it. And that was pretty much real.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about it, and I thought, the closest we could come, Rose and I, since we had time to think about it and we were talking about it, was, you've probably not read, was it Eon Dragonheart Reborn?
No, I have not.
That has a much stronger character, and because it's set in a China that never was with dragons, and she's in a different sort of a situation, she has the potential to be her own person more. And there's a series that I read, a trilogy by Pamela Dean and, oh gosh, what were they called? And now I won't remember. I'll have to find the name. But it was interesting because it was set with a bunch of kids who played a secret game. I think it was called The Hidden Land The Secret Land or something was the first book. But they would play this, you know, little fantasy game that they'd made up with wizards and things like this. And one summer, it was cousins, and they were separated one summer. One family had moved to Australia, and they are, each set finds a mysterious sword in a hedge. And if you're holding the sword and you go through this hedge, you wind up in the actual land that they were always playing at having. And both sets of cousins meet there, but it's different in mysterious ways that they can't understand. It will follow the game and the little storyline that they had come up with, and then it will suddenly veer in descriptions and in who people are and what they're doing. And so it's a fascinating set of stories. And those kids, although following the stereotypes for that kind of a story and the kinds of characters you'd have, you know, you have the smart one, the awkward one, the, you know, that kind of thing, they also were self-aware enough that they kept themselves out of those stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, the 16-year-old girl falls in love with somebody, and she finally figures it out, and she's like, ah, I hate this. This is so stupid. Every heroine in every book does this. I refuse to be this person, and now I am this person. Ugh. You know, so it kind of helps break the spell of just blindly following that pattern.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I need to think about this some more. I haven't had enough time to really come up with examples, but I do know that this book, Jane Eyre, I come away with feeling about Jane Eyre that I never had for Katniss in three novels.
Yeah, you know, Jane is a whole person.
There is a depth of her character and a likability, you know, that I never felt for Katniss Everdeen.
Yeah, and you feel like if Jane and Katniss met, the contrast between the two characters would be so striking because Jane would completely confuse Katniss. And if they did not agree, Jane would be able to talk rings around her just in expressing herself. And Katniss would be reduced to, that's it, I'm going to shoot you because I don't know what else to do with you. I mean, and I could be not giving Katniss enough credit because I've only read the first book.
Mm-hmm.
So she hasn't had a chance to go on and become the person you see her beginning to be. But I mean, look at Jane in the boarding school even.
Yeah. Yeah.
There she's more like Katniss than anything. And she's about 8. By the time she's 17 is when she's going, you know what? I could put an ad in a paper and get a job and go on and okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she's dealing with, as gothic as they are, they're all real world situations.
Yeah.
They're all, I'm falling in love with you, but I probably can't have you. It's so inappropriate to say, oh my gosh, you're promised to another person, or, you know, you're married. Mm. Nope, not going to do this. I mean, the basic stuff is stuff we all can relate to on however pale a scale, because I'm thankful to say my house is not set on fire while I'm asleep.
I haven't been set on fire while in bed for months.
Thank goodness. You must have cleared your attic out lately. Or your wife is a good guardian.
That's right.
Dumping that water on you when you need
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow.
But they're all things we can still relate to, don't you? I mean, did you feel that way?
I feel that way 100%, you know. And part of it is the setting of Hunger Games, maybe. I mean, Katniss does have to react. There are times where she can't be proactive. And, you know, proactivity may be part of this whole thing because, you know, Jane does create her story. She does decide to go to Rochester's house. You know, when she decides to leave that boarding school, you know, it's her decision. She could have stayed there or done something different. But when, you know, one of the people she likes decides to leave, she says, you know what? I think I'm going to move on. And, I don't know. I guess that's what I'm saying is a lot of the feeling about Katniss may be because of she just has to react to her situation.
Well, but you know, there are times when Katniss has, and for those of you who haven't read The Hunger Games, I do recommend that book. So go read it since we're talking about that too. But Katniss does have moments where she's in control of herself.
Mm-hmm.
She has control of how does she feel about Pete and how does she, if that's how you say his name,
yeah.
and how do you respond to him?
Yeah.
How's she going to respond to the training? How's she going to respond when the judges are looking at her skills?
Mm-hmm.
What does she do? Does she plan something? Does she think about it? No. She just does what feels right. Well, good thing she didn't trip when she pulled that arrow.
Mm-hmm.
One of the judges would have been dead. I mean,
yeah.
It's the way that Jane reacts, even though she sets into motion. I mean, well, and Katniss is in charge. Katniss puts herself up there instead of her sister.
Yeah, she does. Yep.
She takes that action. Just like Jane says, I am not doing this. I am leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's at the mercy of the elements for 3 days. And yes, she probably wouldn't make it, but she humbled herself in a way that I never saw Katniss do. Katniss wasn't ever reduced to having to eat pig slop, to having to go up to people that she, you know, was like, oh, I know exactly what you think of me. She always remained independent, a little better viewed than the other people because she had that style because the people helped her have her image, which there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
I get that. But Jane took everything that was given to her in life, too. I mean, she was at the mercy of her elders until she was a certain age.
Yeah.
She was looked down by all those people around her. She had the, you know, when she goes to the gypsy, look how she acts with the gypsy versus how everybody else acted. You know, Katniss has that opportunity too, and she just lets everybody dress her and lets her, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But Would Jane have done that? She didn't let Mr. Rochester do it.
No, she didn't.
And they're the same age, and they've had the same opportunities to develop mental toughness. But Katniss is just, and Katniss could have had that. But what I think is it's really showing a feeling of the sorts of requirements from authors of themselves. That author did not write a deep book. Was it in her to write it? I don't know, because I don't know what her intentions were. But Charlotte Bronte, you could tell she wrote this book for herself first.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell she was having fun with it. I know. Let's have the crazy wife in the attic. I know. Let's, you know, and she puts all that other stuff in there because it's important to Jane as a character. But the reason it's a full book is because the author had something in her that had to be expressed fully. The author who wrote this, or Nancy Drew, that's fine, mm-hmm. was following the formula. Doesn't mean you can't learn something good from the formula, but you're never going to mistake Nancy Drew for Hester Prynne from The Scarlet Letter.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to mistake Katniss for Jane Eyre. They're right. just not deep, fully developed characters because those authors weren't trying to say something that deep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Nathaniel Hawthorne, he had a point he was making. Jane Eyre is written for the same reason. And these people, there's nothing wrong with following a formula. But think about when we talked about Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you take especially those early books separately, and they're following a formula, and they stand alone, and they're simple because they're written about kids. But look, by the time you get to the end of the series, she was aiming for something bigger and richer and deeper.
Yep,
these
true.
Authors of this other stuff, I can thoroughly enjoy these books and say that they're good. I don't have anything against them, but they're cookie cutter in a way. However inventive they get, White Cat, Red Glove, kind of the same way.
Mm.
You know, it's those I would say are a touch deeper than these, and I'd be curious to see where they're going with it, but same thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. Because they're not taking the time and thought and reflection. And what do these people care about? You know, the YA cookie cutter formula. It's like mysteries. You find sometimes some deep mysteries and sometimes the ones that are, well, they're thrillers. They follow the formula I like. That's fine. But when everybody's not trying to be a thriller hero,
mm-hmm.
these YA books, they are holding forth. They're reflecting, what do we think are good qualities in young women? And I don't know what the guy ones are, because the only guy ones I've read are the White Cat, Red Glove, and those are written by a woman.
Hmm.
They seem to me to be true to how a guy would be. But I'm not a guy. I haven't read them.
Gotcha. So I haven't read those either.
What a guy would think.
Yeah.
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 So, you know, Addison, if you're out there, because I hear he's still listening, Will Duquette,
mm-hmm.
Jeff Miller, and other people who don't speak up very much, you know, I'd love to have your thoughts on this, because I think it's worth thinking about as we read other books. Just because they're old doesn't mean they're the only well-developed books, but what are the newer ones? You know, mm-hmm. you've got To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, that's not brand new, but mm-hmm. it's not Jane Eyre.
Right, right.
It's not that time period, but it's fully developed and has a lot of threads.
Mm-hmm.
Gone with the Wind, which is more potboiler, but still.
You know, look at the Odyssey. I'm looking forward. Yeah, let's see what people have to say. I'll think about it some more myself.
Yeah, me too. So. I've been keeping my eyes open. It's been really distressing me. I couldn't think of anything. When the best thing I could think of was The Princess Diaries, because she's in a realistic thing environment as a teenager, I knew I was in deep trouble.
Oh,
maybe
fun.
I just haven't read enough. I don't of that sort of book. I don't know.
Right, right. Yep.
Yeah.
All right.
But think of The Reapers of the Angels.
Yeah.
That's not YA.
Mm-mm.
But it could be if you just cut a couple things out.
Yeah.
And look at the depth that you get in that book. Again, it's not Jane Eyre, but it's not Katniss either.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's stuff out there. It's just, what is it?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, sorry.
No.
I don't want to beat the horse to death. But
oh, gotcha.
It's just interesting to think about.
Yeah, sure is. All right, well, what do we got coming up next?
Let's see. Oh, yeah.
It's your movie.
Not to be?
Yes, that's it.
43,
42, 44. Cool. Looking forward to that.
Ernst Lubitsch, if that's the right name, was the director. And he's one of those people who, this is the only thing of his I've seen, but once you see that name, you start seeing other people mention other movies by him. And
good.
Yeah.
Well, cool.
A comedy.
Right. All right.
In Poland during the German occupation.
Looking forward to that. And then the next book is going to be A Good Man is Hard to Find in Other Stories by Flannery O'Connor.
Whoa.
When we first decided to do this podcast, and the whole reason it's named what it is Flannery O'Connor is kind of a patron of this podcast. Mm-hmm. And it's high time we talk about her.
That's right.
Yeah.
Even if it kills us to read these stories. Okay, me. Kills me to read these stories.
You bet.
Because so we'll she's famous for, she's one of the people that's always mentioned when people talk about Southern Gothic.
Mm-hmm.
Her stories are famously rich and deep and kind of have a lot of things like crazy people in attics, but worse. Much
right,
worse.
Right. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, so we'll pick a few stories out of there, I guess.
Yeah, well, we'll decide how we want to talk about it. We certainly can't talk about every story in there, or we'd be here for a long time. So we'll just maybe between ourselves decide which ones to talk about. But I plan on reading the whole thing. And
I was going to say I'll read it all, but we'll see.
And we'll just decide how we want to do it. So
okay.
All right. Okay.
That sounds great.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yep.
We'll
see you in a couple weeks.
In a couple weeks with To Be or Not To Be.
Yes.
Which
that is
the question.
Goodbye.
All right. See you. Bye-bye.